Alvarez is your married name. I'm divorced. Pete's my ex. Peter Alvarez, the radio talk show host? The very one, she said. I take it Michael mentioned me. Briefly. He told me you were estranged. Did he tell you why? No, and I didn't ask. Shall I fill you in? To what end? I think you should know what you're dealing with. Thanks, but no thanks. A conversation about him is inappropriate. Hear me out, please. I debated with myself. Technically, I was no longer in his employ, and nothing she said would have any bearing on the job he'd hired me to do. I couldn't imagine where she was headed, and I confess my curiosity got the better of me. Keep it short, I said, as though a brief airing of the dirty laundry would be less objectionable. I'll have to backtrack first. No doubt, I said. Long-winded storytelling must have been a family trait. Michael had done the same thing, making sure the facts were arranged in date order. I could see her composing sentences in her head. Michael's been depressed all his life. As a child, he was always anxious, subject to all manner of imaginary illnesses. He did poorly at Klimp and barely managed to graduate. He couldn't find a job, and since he had no income, he asked Mom and Dad if he could go on living at home. My parents agreed on one condition. He had to get help. If he'd find a therapist, they'd pay for it. I was getting restless. Unless Michael Sutton was a spree killer, I didn't care about his psychiatric history. She must have caught my impatience because she said, "Bear with me. It would help if you'd get to the point. Are you going to listen to me or not?" She fixed me with a stony stare, and I could barely keep from rolling my eyes. I gestured for her to continue, but I felt like an attorney questioning the relevance of her testimony. The family doctor referred him to a licensed marriage and family counselor, a psychologist named Marty Osborne. Does her name ring a bell? Nope. I could tell she was teasing out the narrative for dramatic effect, and it annoyed me no end. Michael seemed to like her, and we were all relieved. After he'd been seeing her for a couple of months, she suggested his depression was symptomatic of early childhood sexual abuse. Sexual abuse? She said it was just an educated guess, but she felt they should explore the possibility. He didn't believe a word of it, but she assured him it was natural to block trauma of that magnitude. We didn't know any of this at the time. It all came out later. Shit. Shit is right. Diana shook her head. Marty continued to work with him, and little by little, the ugly truth came out. She was using hypnosis and guided imagery to help him recover his repressed memories, sometimes with the aid of amytal sodium. Truth serum? That's correct. Next thing we knew, she'd diagnosed him with multiple personality disorder. As luck would have it, now here's a happy coincidence. She ran an MPD support group, which Michael joined. More cash changed hands, his to hers. Meanwhile, my parents were blissfully unaware of what was happening. My brothers and I were out of the house by then, so we saw much less of him than they did. After 3 months, Michael started seeing her twice a week and talking to her on the phone 3 and 4 times a day. He didn't eat. He scarcely slept. We could see that, psychologically, he was disintegrating, coming apart at the seams. But we thought his getting worse was part of the process of getting better. Little did we know. She persuaded him it would be healing if he confronted the past, which he did with a vengeance. He accused my father of molesting him from the time he was 8 months old. He had these shadowy memories that he knew were real. Soon his hazy mental movie came into focus, and he remembered. My mother was also in on the abuse. Next thing you know, my younger brother Ryan was added to the list. We're talking nasty stuff. Claims of satanic ritual, bestiality, animal sacrifice, you name it. Sounds preposterous. Of course. What made it worse was my parents had no way to defend themselves. Any attempt they made to refute his claims only served to reinforce his conviction that they were guilty as charged. Marty told him abusers always deny what they've done. He moved out of the house, cutting off all contact, which was actually a relief. Then she talked him into collaborating on a book, and that's what blew the lid off. When Mom and Dad got wind of it, they hired an attorney and sued the crap out of her for false memory syndrome. The night before they were set to go to trial, they reached a settlement. I don't know the terms because they signed a confidentiality agreement. Whatever it was, my parents were never able to collect a cent. Marty filed for bankruptcy, and that's the last anybody ever heard from her. For all we know, she's still in private practice, only somewhere else. I don't get it. Why would she do such a thing? Because she could. She saw it as part of her job. In her eyes, she did no wrong. When they took her pretrial deposition, do you know what she said? That even if his story wasn't true, she was there to validate his feelings. If he was convinced he was abused as a child, then she would support him in his beliefs. In other words, if you think you were abused, you were, and that's all it takes. Without proof? She didn't need proof. She said if that was his truth, he could depend on her to keep the faith. Did the family doctor who referred him know what she was up to? In his deposition, he admitted he'd never met her. She'd been recommended by another doctor whose opinion he respected. In a way, it was beside the point. You don't need a doctor's referral to see a therapist. Just look in the yellow pages and pick anyone you like. Some of them even have little boxes advertising their specialties. Self-esteem issues, crisis counseling, anger management, stress, panic attacks. The list goes on and on. Who among us hasn't experienced the occasional rage or anxiety? How do you know which therapists are legitimate? I have no idea. I've never been in therapy. I'm sure most of them are honest and capable. Some might even be skilled. But sexual abuse is like a siren call. There's a ton of money to be made. That's a bit cynical, isn't it? Not as cynical as you might think. Suppose you go into therapy because your relationships aren't working out the way you'd hoped. Turns out that's a symptom of early childhood abuse. Write me a check and come back next week. You don't remember what was done? That's called being in denial. You've repressed the memory because it was all so traumatic, and you don't want to believe something so horrible would happen at the hands of those you love. Pay me for this session and let's meet again next week so we can get to the root of it. In effect, my parents paid Marty Osborne $6,000 to drive a stake into their hearts. They must have been distraught. They were devastated, and I don't think they ever really got over it. I could barely deal with it myself, and I wasn't one of the accused. After the case was settled, my parents swore they'd put it behind them. They shut the door on the whole ugly episode. They were desperate to believe Michael loved them and everything was okay. Here's how okay it was. A couple of years afterward, my mother died in a drowning accident, and my father dropped dead 6 months later of an aneurysm. He never got around to changing his will, so after what Michael put us through, he inherited an equal share of their estate. That's a tough pill to swallow. What choice did I have? I've made my peace with it. The money was theirs, and they could do with it as they pleased. Maybe that was always my father's intent, to look after him. I could see where she was going. So, you think Michael's memory of the two guys digging is just more of the same? Basically, she said. How did he come up with this story in the first place? Doesn't that sound suspect to you? I'll admit I was skeptical at first, I said. He says he read a reference to Mary Claire in the paper, and it triggered his memory of the whole event. That was years ago. What makes him so sure? He said he saw them on his 6th birthday, July 21st, and that's how he made the association. Your mother left him at Billy Kirkendall's while she ran errands. He was wandering around the property when he saw them. It sounds bogus to me. It wasn't his imagination. There was something buried there. Oh, please, she said. Michael's a drama queen. He can't seem to help himself. Sometimes I think he's delusional or spaced out on drugs. He's incapable of telling the truth. It's not in his nature. He can't tell the difference between what's really true and what he imagines. That caught my attention. In my brief relationship with him, I could cite my experience in support of her claim. He was evasive, omitting critical information from his account of himself. When I called him on it, he corrected himself and filled in the blanks. If I hadn't, I would have ended up with an erroneous impression. I felt protective, nonetheless. I didn't want to sit and say nothing while his sister trashed him. I don't think he fabricated the story. He was six. Maybe he didn't understand what he'd witnessed, but that doesn't mean he lied. That's exactly my point. He takes a simple moment and he embellishes, invents, and exaggerates. Next thing you know, there's an elaborate conspiracy afoot. He sees two men digging a hole, and suddenly it's about Mary Claire's murder and her being buried in that grave. You're implying that he did this deliberately, which I find hard to believe. I'm not telling you this stuff just to hear myself talk. This is how his mind works. You can't believe a word he says. This comes a little late from my perspective. Don't kid yourself. You haven't seen the last of him. It's never over with him. Have you met any of his friends? The shift in subject caught me off guard. One, a girl named Madeline. He told me she was addicted to heroin. And now she's clean, but not sober, Diana interjected derisively. Did he mention she's a lush? 22 years old and she's on probation for public drunkenness? Of course, he's the one who ferries her to AA meetings. He collects losers like her. Anyone in worse shape than he is, if you can imagine such a thing. Sutton's wounded birds. He gets into rescue mode so he can feel good about himself. There's usually two or three of them hanging around at any given time. They move in, they borrow money, they take his car without permission, and wind up in fender benders that he ends up paying for out of pocket. Some land in jail while loudly protesting their innocence. He bails them out and brings them home again because they have nowhere else to go. That's when they steal his credit cards and go on a spending jag. Poor judgment. Very poor. I can't tell you the money he's gone through. What scares me is thinking about what'll happen when he's emptied all his bank accounts. He's never really worked. He's held jobs, but none for long. The money he inherited is the only thing keeping him afloat. Once that's gone, he'll end up on my doorstep begging for help. What's my choice then? I take him in, or he ends up living on the street. You're not obligated. That's what my brothers tell me. Why do it then? I guess I feel guilty because he's such a mess, and the rest of us are okay. As she went on, I could hear my own story echoed in hers. My grievances, my determination to hang on to everything that seemed unfeeling or unfair. Her complaints were legitimate, but so what? The recital of her woes only made matters worse, keeping the pain alive when it should have been laid to rest. Diana must have realized I'd clocked out. Why are you looking at me that way? I have family issues of my own, and they sound just like yours. Different scenario, but the angst is the same. Personally, I'm getting tired of hearing myself whine. And if I'm tired, what about the people around me who have to put up with my shit? It's not the same. Sure it is. What's the point in going over and over it? I'll bet you've told the same story 100 times. Why don't you give it a rest? If I give it up, Michael wins. Bad behavior triumphs over good yet again. Well, I'm sick of it. After the havoc he's wreaked, why should I let him off the hook? I could feel myself getting irritated. I understood where she was coming from, but the events she'd described were years in the past. Waltzing into my office to unload it all on me was out of line. She'd turned venom into a lifestyle, and it wasn't attractive. On first meeting, I'd been put off by her aggressiveness. Now I was put off by her attempt to rope me into Sutton bashing. What hook, Diana? He's not on the hook except in your mind. He's living his own life, and if he's screwing up right and left, what's it to you? Her smile was tight. You say that now, but you're not done with him, trust me. You gave him credence, which has been in short supply of late. He'll come back. Some new crisis will emerge. Some disturbing turn of events. That's my lookout, don't you think? You really don't believe me, do you? I've heard every word. I understand why you're pissed off at him, but I take offense at the wholesale condemnation. Give the kid a break. You came here to warn me. You've done that, and I thank you. I'm on red alert. That shut her down. She withdrew as though I'd slapped her. She snatched up her shoulder bag and took out a business card. Here's my number if you should ever need to get in touch. I'm sorry to have taken up so much of your time. As she reached the door, she paused. You want to hear the best part? I was going to fire off a smart remark, but I held my tongue. 6 days after Daddy died, Michael saw the light. He became a retractor. He disavowed his claims about the sexual abuse. He said he realized Marty Osborne had planted all those memories. Oops. Big mistake. He took it all back. So that's who you're dealing with. Have a nice day. She left the office, banging the door shut behind her. Chapter 11. I had dinner that night at Rosie's, the tavern located half a block from my apartment. It's the perfect setting for the neighborhood drinking crowd and serves as a ready substitute for my non-existent social life. In the summer months, the softball rowdies dominate the bar, celebrating victories so minor they scarcely warrant column space in the local sports pages. From time to time, they put together touch football teams, the losers paying off the winners with a pony keg. Prior to the Super Bowl, there are endless noisy debates, arguments, and wagers, which are finally settled by pitching in $10 each and drawing names from an oversized beer stein Rosie keeps behind the bar. Rosie is Hungarian by birth, and though she's been in Santa Teresa most of her life, she refuses to give up her accent or her tortured sentence structure. She and Henry's brother, William, were married Thanksgiving Day 3.5 years ago. It's an unlikely match, but one that's turned out to be good for both of them. I took a seat in my favorite booth at the rear of the bar. Before I could get my windbreaker off, Rosie appeared and set an empty wine glass on the table. She'd apparently just dyed her hair, which was a deeply saturated shade of red I'd never actually seen on a human head. She held up a wine jug with a screw top and a label pasted on the front. Mongrel White, 1988. She upended the jug and poured the wine, which actually made a glug, glug, glug sound as it tumbled into my glass. I know you're supposed to sip first and say if you like, but this is all I got. Take or leave him. I'll take. You need eating better. It's too thin. So what I'm giving you is bean soup with pork knuckle. I'd say Hungarian name, but you forget, so what's to bother? Henry's bringing me fresh baked rolls. I give you plenty with a side of Hungarian cheese spread you're gonna love. Fine, I can't wait. There was no point in arguing with her because she always gets her way. I find bossy women restful as they take all the decision-making out of your hands. Conniving women are the ones who really set my teeth on edge, though Rosie probably does a bit of that as well. She went to the kitchen, order pad in hand, and returned moments later with the promised repast on a tray. She balanced the tray on the table edge and set the big bowl of soup in front of me, followed by a basket of napkin-wrapped rolls and a ramekin of cheese spread. I placed a hand on the napkin and felt the warm rolls underneath. I ate with a series of oinky little sounds consistent with a voracious appetite and a thorough appreciation of what was going down my gullet. At 7 o'clock, I decided to head home, my intention being to change into my sweats and lounge around on my sofa reading the paperback mystery I was halfway through. I shrugged into my windbreaker and adjusted the collar. With the sun down, it would be chilly walking even a half a block. I zipped up and hoisted my bag across my shoulder. When I tucked a hand in one pocket, my fingers curled around the tag Cheney'd dropped in my palm the day before. I pulled it out and studied it. which I hadn't had a chance to do. The plastic disc was encrusted with dirt. I crossed the room to the bar where William was working, dapper as usual in his dark gray wool serge suit pants, white dress shirt, and tie. He'd shed his suit coat and placed it on a coat hanger suspended on a wall hook nearby. His only other concessions to his job were the two cones of paper towel he'd secured over his shirt sleeves with rubber bands to keep his cuffs clean. I put my check on the bar along with a $10 bill. My meal was $7.65, including the bad wine. "Keep the change," I said. William swooped up both. "Thanks. You want anything else? Rosie made an apple strudel that will knock your socks off." "I better not, but I'd love a glass of soda water." "Certainly. Would you care for ice?" "Nope." "A slice of lemon or lime?" "Just plain." I watched as he filled a Tom Collins glass with soda from an 8-button dispenser gun. "You have an extra bar towel I could borrow? A dirty one will do." He reached under the bar and removed a damp towel he must have stowed earlier. William's a stickler for sanitation. He sees the world as one big petri dish fermenting God knows what microbes and death-dealing bacteria. I perched on a bar stool where the light was good and cleaned the grunge off the tag. On one side, there was a phone number. On the other, the dog's name, which was Ulf. I lifted the limp leather collar to my nose, noting that it still carried the faint scent of rot. I put the tag back in my jacket pocket, returned the bar towel, and gave William a quick wave. Outside, the night air felt chilly and the street was deserted. It was only a little after 7, but the neighbors were home and buttoned up for the night. After 21 years, it probably wasn't possible to determine whether Ulf had died of old age or if he'd been put down because of illness or injury. The pirates probably had a good laugh at Sutton's expense, spinning the yarn about a treasure map. I was guessing Sutton would have been just as enthralled by a doggy funeral with a bit of pomp and ceremony thrown in. I wasn't sure what had generated my musings except a lingering defensiveness about Sutton's ending up with egg on his face. How his sister must have loved that, seeing him make a public fool of himself. Ah, well. Once I reached my apartment and closed the door behind me, I secured the locks, turned on a couple of lamps, and adjusted the louvered shutters. Then I changed into my comfies, grabbed a quilt, and settled on the couch to read. Happily, I had a weekend coming up, and I intended to goof off for the whole of it, which is exactly what I did. Monday morning was a wash, busy but otherwise forgettable. The afternoon was taken up with a due diligence request for an Arizona mortgage company interested in hiring a high-level executive. According to his resume, he'd lived and worked in Santa Teresa from June of 1969 until February of 1977. There was nothing to suggest he was hiding information, but the human resources director had been in touch, asking me to do a sweep of public records. If irregularities came to light, they'd send one of their investigators to do a follow-up. I was looking at half a day's work at best, but it wouldn't be strenuous. A paycheck is a paycheck, and I was happy to oblige. At 10 o'clock, I walked over to the courthouse and spent the next 2 hours trolling the index of civil and criminal suits, property liens, tax assessments, judgments, bankruptcy filings, marriage licenses, and divorce decrees. There was no evidence of wrongdoing and no suggestion the fellow had ever crossed swords with the law. The problem was that there was no evidence of the guy at all. I had been given an address on the Upper East Side. On his application, the guy claimed he'd bought the house in 1970 and lived there until he sold it in 1977, but the owner of record was someone else entirely. Since the public library was just across the street, I left the courthouse and jaywalked, approaching the entrance with a suitable sense of anticipation. I love shit like this, catching liars in the act. His fabrications had been so specific and detailed he must have felt safe, assuming no one would ever bother to check. I returned to the reference department where I'd spent such a satisfactory hour the week before. I shed my windbreaker and hung it across the back of a chair while I pulled the Santa Teresa city directories for the years in question. Again, a fingertip search turned up no trace of the guy. I cross-checked the address and the Haynes and Polk and came up with nothing. Well, wasn't that a kick in the pants? I was on my way out of the building when I remembered the dog tag. I took it out again and studied it, tempted by the phone number on one side. It wouldn't take 5 minutes to look it up in the Haynes. Maybe I'd never know the whole story, but I might glean the odd bit of information. The issue wasn't pressing. My curiosity was idle and wouldn't have warranted a separate trip to the library. However, I was already on the premises, and the effort required would be minimal. I returned to the reference department, which I was beginning to regard as my adjunct office. I took out both the 1966 and the 1967 Polk and Haynes directories and sat down at what I was beginning to think of as my personal table. I put the tag down beside me and leafed through the Haynes until I found the same 3-digit prefix. I worked my way down the sequence of numbers until I found a match. In both directories, the number was assigned to a P.F. Sanchez. By flipping back and forth between the Haynes and the Polk, I found an address for him, though it wasn't a street name I recognized. His occupation was contractor, no indication of a wife. I returned the directories to the shelf and then crossed to the section where the telephone directories were lined up. I pulled the current Santa Teresa phone book and looked in the S's, running down the listings until I came to Sanchez, P.F. His telephone number was the same, as was his address on Tsarina Avenue. Where the heck was that? I walked back to my office, sat down at my desk, and hauled out my Thomas Guide to Santa Teresa and Perdido Counties. Tsarina Avenue was actually in Perdido County, one of half a dozen streets that formed a grid in the tiny coastal town of Puerto, a name that had morphed into the longer Puerto Polvoriento, which was then shortened to Peepole, and from there to Peepole. I sat and pondered the geography. I'd hoped to feel better informed, which in some ways I was. What puzzled me now was why a man who lived in Peepole would bury his dead dog in Horton Ravine, a good 15 miles north. There must have been some quirky set of circumstances to explain the digging of the dog's grave at such a remove. I put my feet on the desk, leaned back in my swivel chair, and put a call through to Cheney Phillips at the PD. After 2 rings, he picked up, and when I identified myself, I could hear the smile in his voice. "Hey, kid. I hope you didn't take offense at my teasing you about the doggy exhumation." "Oh, you know me better than that. I'm just thankful Mary Claire Fitzhugh wasn't buried in that hole," I said. "I'm sorry about the waste of manpower. I owe you one. If I had a dollar for every lead that didn't pan out, I'd be rich. Anyway, I'm the one who referred the kid to you in the first place, so it's not like you cooked this up on your own." "I do feel for him. How embarrassing." "He'll survive," Cheney said. "So, what's the story on Diana Sutton?" There was a pause. "Refresh my memory." "Sorry, I should have said Diana Alvarez." "The reporter? What about her?" "Did you know she was Michael Sutton's sister?" "You're not serious." "I knew she was persistent, but I wrote it off to her job." "How do you know her?" "I don't. Or at least I didn't until Friday morning. She came into my office, took a seat, and unloaded with both barrels. I filled him in on Sutton's sorry tale of woe, at the end of which he said, 'Even if I'd known his sordid history, I'd have reacted the same way. I thought his story had a ring of truth.'" "Me too. Apparently, she's made it her mission to screw him over any chance she can. The dog gave her the ammunition to go after him again." "Hold on a second." He put a hand over the mouthpiece and then came back. "I gotta scoot. Anything else?"
"One quick question. Can you tell me the dog's breed? I know the body must have been in bad shape, but could you tell anything about him from what was left?"
"Well, he was big. I'd say 70 to 80 pounds once upon a time. Most of his coat was intact. The hair was long and coarse,
A mix of black and gray with maybe some shades of brown thrown in. It looked like the tag was an afterthought tossed in on top of him.
A German Shepherd?
Something like that. Why?
I was just curious.
Oh, Lord. Not again. Stay out of trouble, if you can, he said, and hung up. I took a moment to place a call to Phoenix, Arizona, filling in the HR director on her phantom executive. She gave me a fax number and asked for an account of my coverage. I typed up my notes and then walked one block over to the notary's office and used her fax machine. I had 2 pages to send, and the process took 5 minutes, which I thought was nothing short of miraculous. One day I'd break down and buy a machine of my own, but to date I didn't need one often enough to justify the expense. I retrieved my Mustang, gassed up at the entrance to the 101, and headed down the coast to Peephole, population 400. The area, like so much of California, was part of a Spanish land grant deeded to Amador Santiago Delgado in 1831. His mother was distantly related to Maria Cristina of Bourbon, Two Sicilies, the fourth wife of King Ferdinand VII, and the only one of his wives to bear him living offspring. There was no clear explanation for Maria Cristina's generosity, but Amador inherited title to the land when his mother died. He and his young bride, Dulcinea Medina Vargas, traveled from Barcelona to Perdido, California, took possession of the tract, and established a large working ranch devoted to the raising of purebred Spanish horses. Within a year, Dulcinea died, giving birth to their only child, a daughter, Pilar Santiago Vargas. Bereft, Amador sold off his horses and turned to the deeply satisfying solace of drink. On his death in 1860, Pilar inherited his massive land holdings, which had largely reverted to the elements. At the time, she was 30 years old and not a beautiful girl. But she was clever, and her wealth more than compensated for the hefty frame and plain countenance nature had bestowed on her. When the Homestead Act was passed in 1862, land-hungry settlers poured into California from all over the country, eager to claim the 160 acres, 65 hectares per person, promised by the government. Harry Flanagan was one of these. He was a blue-eyed Irishman with bright red hair, muscular arms, and a strong back and shoulders geared for hard labor. In Ireland, Harry Flanagan had been a poor man, and the opportunity to own land was heady stuff to him. He took his time, traveling up and down the California coast for months before he chose his spot and filed a claim with the nearest land office in Los Angeles. As was required, he attested that he was 21 years of age and swore he'd never borne arms against the United States or given comfort to its enemies. He further declared his intention of improving the plot with crops and a dwelling, with the understanding that if he was still on the land in 5 years, the property would be his, free and clear. The rugged acreage he'd chosen was beautiful, but there was little or no fresh water on it, and farming was precarious. Despite its proximity to the Pacific Ocean, the land was arid, and the irony wasn't lost on him. Nothing but water as far as the eye could see, and none of it was usable. No one bothered to tell him that for the past 25 years, the idyllic-looking harbor had been known as Puerto Polvoriento, Port Dusty. Regardless of its obvious shortcomings, he was convinced he could turn the land to his advantage, and he set about it with a will. The only small impediment to his ambition was the fact that the 65 hectares he'd laid claim to infringed in its entirety on the land that belonged to Pilar Santiago Vargas. Not surprisingly, this came to her attention, which prompted her to mount her horse and ride out to challenge the audacious interloper. It was never clear how the encounter played out, or what wiles the plucky farmer employed in defense of his hopes, but the upshot was that Harry Flanagan took Pilar Santiago Vargas as his lawful wedded wife within the month. He was not, after all, a man to quibble about a few excess pounds. With regard to her homeliness, he was also motivated to make allowances. Some 8.5 months later, she bore him a son, the first of 7 boys who arrived at 2-year intervals, a band of fiery-haired Hispanics. By agreement, Pilar and Harry took turns naming their boy chicks, who were respectively Joaquin, Ronan, Bendito, Andrew, Miguel, Liam, and Placido. Harry and Pilar were married for 52 years, until he was struck down in the influenza epidemic of 1918. Pilar lived on another 19 years and died in 1937 at the age of 101. Harry's crowning achievement was the founding of the Flanagan Water Company, which provided water to the citizens of Peephole for 25 cents a gallon, making him rich beyond imagining. Thereafter, he spearheaded construction of the Puerto Dam, which was completed in 1901 and provided a distribution system that delivered running water to the town. Oddly enough, in the years I'd lived in Santa Teresa, I'd rarely been to Peephole, and I was looking forward to seeing it again. Chapter 12. Walker McNally. Monday, April 11th, 1988. Mr. McNally. He became aware that someone was addressing him. He opened his eyes. He didn't recognize the woman who was bending close. She had a hand on his arm, which she was shaking insistently. Her expression showed impatience or concern, and since he didn't know her, he wasn't sure which. The overhead light was bright, and the ceiling tiles looked institutional, designed to dampen sound, though he couldn't remember the name for them. Mr. McNally, can you hear me? He wanted to reply, but there was a heaviness that filled his body, and the effort was too great. He had no idea what was going on, and no memory of events that might explain his lying on his back, immobilized, with this woman leaning over him. Something hurt. Had he had surgery? The pain wasn't acute. More like a dull ache that radiated through his body with a thick layer of white on top, as cold and heavy as a blanket of snow. The woman stepped aside, and 2 copies of Carolyn's face came into his visual frame, one slightly offset like a watery duplicate. Nausea stirred as the surface ripples widened and dissipated near the edges of his view. She said, "Walker." He focused, and the 2 images locked into one like a magic trick. "Do you know where you are?" Again, he wanted to respond, but he couldn't move his lips. He was so tired, he could scarcely pay attention. "Do you remember what happened?" Her look was expectant. Clearly, she wanted an answer, but he had none to give. "You were in an accident," she said. Accident? That made sense. He took in the words, searching for corresponding images of what had occurred. Nothing came to him. Had he fallen? Had he been struck in the head by a bullet or a stone? Here he was on his back. Before here was blank. "Do you remember going off the road?" Nope. He wanted to shake his head so she'd know he heard her, but he couldn't manage it. Road. Car. The concept was simple, and he got it. He knew there'd been an accident, but he couldn't imagine his relationship to it. He was alive. He supposed he'd been hurt, and he wondered how badly. His brain must still function, even if his body was temporarily, or perhaps permanently, out of commission. Carolyn knew, and he was willing to take her word for it, but the idea was odd. "Do you know what day this is?" Clueless. He couldn't even remember the last day he remembered. She said, "Monday. The kids and I got back from San Francisco late this afternoon, and your car was gone. I unloaded the suitcases, and I was letting the kids watch a few minutes of TV when a police car pulled into the drive. There was a wreck on the pass. Your car was totaled. It's a wonder you're not dead." He closed his eyes. He had no recollection whatsoever. He had no idea why he'd been on the 154, and no memory of a collision. From his perspective, there was only a yawning black hole, a blank wall that separated this current moment from the recent past. Dimly, he remembered leaving the bank on Thursday, but the door had slammed shut on anything after that. A doctor appeared, a neurologist named Blake Berrigan, whom he recognized from the country club. Berrigan was interested in Walker's cognitive functions and ran him through a series of tests. Walker knew his own name. He knew Ronald Reagan was president of the United States, even if he hadn't voted for the man. He could count backward from 100 by eights, a task he wasn't sure he could manage ordinarily. Berrigan was middle-aged and solemn, and while Walker could see his mouth move and knew he was conveying reassurances about his condition, he was too tired to care. The next time he opened his eyes, he was in a private room, and people were talking in the hall. He consulted his body. His right elbow ached, and his chest felt compressed where they'd apparently taped his ribs. He touched the right side of his head and felt a painful knot. He probably had minor injuries he wasn't aware of yet. He could smell cooked meat and the scent of green beans with a metallic edge, reminiscent of the canned variety of his youth. The clatter outside the door suggested a meal cart with food trays. A nurse's aide came in and asked if he was hungry. Without waiting for a response, she lowered the rail on one side, cranked up his bed, and placed a tray on the rolling bed table, which she pushed within range. There was a carton of orange juice and a small container of cherry Jell-O, sealed with an elasticized plastic cover like a little shower cap. "What's today? Sunday?" "Monday," she said. "You were admitted from the ER an hour ago, so you missed dinner. Do you remember coming in?" "Is my wife here?" "She just left. A neighbor was watching the children and she had to put them to bed. She'll be back in the morning." "Are you in pain?" He shook his head in the negative, stirring the headache he hadn't been aware of. "I don't understand what happened." "Dr. Berrigan can explain everything when he gets here. He has a patient on the surgical floor, and he said he'd look in on you again before he left for the day. Can I get you anything else?" "I'm fine." Once his supper tray had been removed, he opened the bed table drawer and found a pocket mirror. He checked his reflection. He had two black eyes, a purple knot on his forehead, and a smoky discoloration on the right side of his face. He must have hit the windshield or steering wheel on impact. He put the mirror away, realizing he was lucky he didn't have cuts or broken facial bones. At 9 o'clock, a nurse appeared with a tray of meds. She verified his name by checking his hospital bracelet, and then handed him a small pleated paper cup with two pills in it. When he was a kid, his mother had given him cups the same size filled with M&Ms. "To help you sleep," she said when she saw the look on his face. "Do you need a urinal?" The minute she said it, he realized his bladder was full and the pressure close to painful. "Please." She set down her tray and removed a lidded plastic urinal from the cabinet beside his bed. The device had a handle and a slanted spout and looked like something his kids could invent 100 uses for at the beach. "I'll leave this with you. You can ring when you're done." "Thanks." She pulled the curtain along its track, shielding him from the curious eyes of those passing in the hall. He waited until she was gone and then rolled to his left and angled his penis into the opening of the urinal. Despite his best intentions, nothing would come. He tried to relax. He put his mind on something else, but the only thing he could think about was his need for relief. He would have laughed if the need to pee hadn't been so imperative. He'd suffered something similar when he and Carolyn were undergoing infertility treatments, and he was asked to ejaculate into a cup so his sperm could be examined under a microscope, and then washed before each of the 5 fruitless intrauterine inseminations they'd undergone. He took a deep breath, hoping his bladder would relent. A pointless enterprise. He gave up for the moment, and when the pressure was unbearable, he rang the nurse's station. 15 minutes passed before the aide appeared. She palpated his abdomen and then went to consult a nurse, who returned to the room accompanied by a student nurse. She had a catheterization packet with her, and she opened it and took out the Foley, a pair of latex gloves, and a packet of lubricant. She viewed the situation as a teaching opportunity. She grasped his penis and explained how to pass the Foley into the bladder by way of his urethra. "I hope you don't mind," she said to him as an aside. "That's fine," Walker said. If she didn't get on with it, his bladder would burst. He only half listened, distancing himself from what was going on. "The size of the Foley is indicated in French units," she was saying to the student nurse. "The most common sizes are 10F to 28F. 1F is equivalent to 0.33 millimeters, or 0.013 inches, 1/77th of an inch in diameter." After she instructed the student nurse in the proper technique, she encouraged her to try her hand at it. The girl was apologetic. Her fingers were ice cold and trembling. After two failed attempts, the nurse took over and inserted the catheter with remarkable efficiency. The relief was a miracle. The whole encounter was humiliating, but he was already converting it to an amusing anecdote he'd tell at the next cocktail party. He finally managed to fall asleep, though he was awakened four times in the night, twice for a check of his vital signs, once when the pain in his ribs became insistent and he had to ask for medication, and once because an aide came into his room by mistake, thinking he was someone else. At some point during the night, he realized Blake Berrigan, the shit, had never stopped by. At 8:30 the next morning, Carolyn arrived. The timing was such that he figured she just dropped Fletcher and Linney off at preschool. At least he was alert now and fully awake, though he still drew a blank when it came to the accident. He knew they had top-notch insurance coverage, so he wasn't worried about the expense. It was the hassle of paperwork and the inconvenience of being without transportation until he picked up a rental car. The headache was creeping up again, starting at the base of his skull. Carolyn took off her coat and placed it over the arm of the upholstered chair. It took him 10 seconds to register the fact that she wasn't looking at him, and another 10 to realize how angry she was. Carolyn was ordinarily easygoing, but once in a while something set her off, and then there was hell to pay. This mood, he knew. Cold, withdrawn, her face pale with rage. Is something wrong? He didn't much feel like the verbal beating he knew would follow. He had no idea what she was so pissed off about, but if he didn't ask now, she'd freeze him out until he did. "I take it Blake Berrigan didn't stop by last night to bring you up to speed," she said. Fleetingly, he thought Blake's being remiss might explain her attitude. Carolyn took these matters seriously. She had high standards for herself, and she expected others to anticipate her requirements and behave accordingly. If Blake said he'd stop by, then by God, he'd better do it. Walker said, "Not that I'm aware." The nurse said he had a patient on the surgical floor. "You killed a girl." "Excuse me?" "You heard what I said." In a flash, he felt his body disconnect from his soul, like a caboose uncoupled and left behind on the track as the rest of the train moved on. He found himself floating in one corner of the room, looking down on himself. He could see the expression of bewilderment on his face. He could see the crooked part in Carolyn's hair, her features foreshortened from his perspective. For a moment, he wondered if he'd died. Actually, he hoped he had, because what she'd told him was too horrendous to absorb. His mouth was so dry, he couldn't muster speech. Carolyn talked on, her tone indifferent, as though she were speaking of matters unrelated to him. She was 19 years old. She was on spring break, her sophomore year at UCST. She'd driven to San Francisco to spend the weekend with friends. She told her mother she wanted to avoid the late afternoon traffic, so she left the city Monday morning at 9. At 4:20, She came over the hill on the 154, just 3 miles from home. She was halfway down the pass when you crossed the center line and struck her Carmen Ghia head on. She never had a chance. Carolyn closed her mouth, her lips forming a tight line while she got control of herself. He shook his head. Carolyn, I swear to God, I don't remember any of this. Oh, really? She said, all cynicism. You don't remember going into the sports bar at State and La Cuesta Monday afternoon? I didn't even know there was one. Bullshit. The Whiz Inn. We've passed it 100 times and you always make a joke about the name. You were drunk when you got there Monday afternoon, loud and obnoxious. You insisted on service, but the bartender refused, and when he asked you to leave, you were belligerent. He ended up calling the police the minute you were out the door. A motorist saw you getting on the 101, weaving all over the place. But by the time he got to a gas station and called it in, you'd taken the 154 off-ramp and you were heading up the pass. That's not right. That can't be. There were 3 other witnesses, 2 joggers, and a guy in a pickup truck you barely missed. He ended up going off the road. He's lucky he didn't end up dead as well. I'm drawing a blank. That's called an alcoholic blackout, in case you haven't figured it out. Forget what went on and you absolve yourself of blame. What better way to sidestep guilt than to blot it out of your mind? You think I did this on purpose? You know me better than that. When have I ever... Carolyn rode right over him. You know what's odd? We saw her, the girl you killed. The kids and I must have left San Francisco the same time she did. I didn't realize who she was until I came across her picture in this morning's paper. We'd stopped at the Applebee's near Floral Beach. The kids were cranky and hungry and needed a break. She was sitting in the first booth eating a burger and fries as we walked in. We sat in the booth next to hers, and the kids were being silly, peeping at her over the top of the banquette. You know how they do. She started making faces at them, which delighted them no end. She finished her meal before ours arrived, and she waved from the door as she went out. She was so fresh and so pretty. I remembered hoping Linny could be as sweet to little kids when she was the same age. Carolyn's face crumpled, and she put a hand over her mouth, sobbing like a child, rocking back and forth. She held herself at the waist as though she had a stomach ache. He wanted to reach out, but he was aware that any gesture he made would seem woefully inadequate. Had someone really died because of him? Carolyn's anguish was contagious, and he felt tears spill from his own eyes, his weeping as automatic as yawning in the presence of someone who's just yawned. At the same time, in the most detached and clinical part of his brain, he was hoping she'd catch sight of his tears and feel sorry for him. She was capable of mood swings and emotional shifts, being outraged 1 minute and forgiving the next. He needed her on his side, not an enemy, but his ally. "Baby, I'm sorry. I had no idea," he whispered. His voice cracked, and he could feel the tension in his chest as he choked back a sound. "I can't believe it. I'm sick about it." Her face snapped up, her tone incredulous. "You're sick about it? You're sick? You were drunk on your ass. How could you do that? How could you?" "Carolyn, please. You have every right to be furious, but I didn't mean to do it. You have to believe me." He knew he was sounding too rational. This wasn't a time to try persuading her. She was too upset. But how could he survive if she turned on him? All their friends loved Carolyn. They'd take their cue from her. Everyone said she was an angel, considerate, warm, loyal, kind. Her compassion was boundless, unless or until she felt betrayed. Then she was merciless. She'd often accused him of being cold, but at the core of her being, she was the one with a stony heart, not him. He said, "I'm not asking for sympathy. This is something I'll have to live with the rest of my life." Inwardly, he winced because the tone was off. He sounded petulant when he meant to sound remorseful. She took a tissue from her handbag and wiped her eyes, pausing then to blow her nose. She made a sound that was an audible sigh, and he wondered if the worst of the storm had passed. She was shaking her head with a small, sad smile. "Do you want to know what I came home to? You've probably forgotten this along with everything else. I found an empty vodka bottle and 6 empty beer cans tossed in the trash. There was whiskey all over the patio where you'd knocked over the maker's mark. You must have fallen against the table because it was tipped up on its side, and there was broken glass everywhere. It's a wonder you didn't cut your own throat." She paused and pressed the tissue against her mouth. She shook her head again, saying, "I don't know you, Walker. I have no idea who you are or what you're about. I'm serious. What do you want me to say? I'm sorry. I'll never have another drink again as long as I live. I give you my word. Oh, for God's sake, spare me. Look at you. You've been drunk for days, and now an innocent girl is dead." He knew better than to go on defending himself. He'd just have to ride it out, let her get it all out of her system, and then maybe she'd relent. He held his hand out, palm up, in a mute plea for contact. She leaned forward. "I'm filing for divorce." "Carolyn, don't say that. I'll quit. I promise you. I don't give a shit about your promises. You said you could quit any time you wanted, but you meant as long as I kept an eye on you. The minute my back was turned, you were at it again, and look at the result. I'm not your keeper. That's not my job. You're in charge of yourself, and you blew it. I know. I understand. I have no defense. I'm begging you not to do this. We're a family, Carolyn. I love you. I love my kids. I'll do anything to make this right." "There's no way to make it right. That poor girl died because of you." "Don't keep saying that. I get it. And you have no idea how horrible I feel. I deserve the worst. I deserve anything you want to throw at me. Hatred, blame, recriminations, you name it. Only please not right now. I need you. I can't get through this without you." Her smile was mocking, and she rolled her eyes. "You are such a horse's ass." "Maybe so, but I'm an honorable man. I'll take full responsibility. You can't condemn me for one lapse of judgment. One lapse? Perhaps along with everything else, you're forgetting your previous DUI. That was years ago. The whole thing was dumb, and you know it. The cop pulled me over because the tag on my license plate expired. The guy was a moron. You said so yourself." "Not so much of a moron. He didn't smell whiskey on your breath and haul you off to jail. I was the one who bailed you out. Because of you, the social worker nearly tossed out our application to adopt." "Fine. All right. I did that, Your Honor. I'm guilty as charged. I've apologized 100 times, but you keep bringing it up. The point is, nothing came of it. No harm, no foul." She got up and reached for her coat. "Tell the judge no harm, no foul at your arraignment. That ought to be good for a laugh." The rest of the day went by in a blur. He feigned more pain than he felt, just to get more medication. God bless Percocet, his new best friend. He picked at his supper tray, then flipped from channel to channel on the TV set, too restless to focus. He ran through the confrontation with Carolyn 100 times. What he hadn't dared confess, for fear of her heaping even more venom on him, was that he actually felt nothing one way or the other. How could he regret consequences when the before and the after and the in-between were gone? At 9 p.m., he woke with a start, unaware that he'd fallen asleep. He heard footsteps in the hall, turned to the door expecting to catch sight of Blake Berrigan. He'd never had much use for the guy, but their wives were friends, and he was sorely in need of a friend himself just now. Berrigan, like most doctors, was capable of keeping judgment at bay, appearing sympathetic whether he felt that way or not. When Herschel Rhodes appeared in the doorway, Walker thought he was hallucinating. Herschel Rhodes? Why was he stepping into his hospital room? Walker had known him at Santa Teresa High School, where the two had occasional classes together. Herschel was a homely teen, awkward and overweight, with bad skin and no social skills. To compensate for his failings, he was earnest and studious, the poor schmuck. Teachers fawned over him because he paid attention in class and actually participated. That's how out of it he was. The boy was hell on raising his hand, and the answers he gave were usually right. He turned in his class assignments on time, even going so far as to type his term papers, including the copious footnotes. What a little kiss-ass. Herschel was one of those kids shunned and ignored by the popular kids. No one was ever outright rude to him, and if he was aware of the smirks and eye-rolling that went on behind his back, he gave no indication of it. He was now in his late 30s, still round-faced, with his dark hair slicked back in a style Walker hadn't seen since the early 1960s. He'd been a merit scholar and graduated from Santa Teresa High, third in his class. Walker had heard he'd graduated from Princeton and had then gone on to Harvard Law. He'd passed the bar the first time around. His specialty was criminal defense. Walker had seen his full-page ad in the Yellow Pages. Murder, domestic violence, DUI, and drug offenses. It seemed like a sleazy way to make a living, but he must have done well at it, because Walker'd seen his house in Montebello and the guy lived well. He'd become better-looking with age, and the traits that were deficits in his teens now stood him in good stead. He was reputed to be a ruthless competitor at anything he undertook, golf, tennis, bridge. Cutthroat was the word they used. He played hard, he played to win, and no one got in his way. Herschel seemed startled at the sight of him.
"Jesus, you look like shit."
Walker said,
"Herschel Rhodes, of all people, I didn't expect to see you."
"Hello, Walker. Carolyn asked me to stop by.
As an attorney or as a friend?"
Herschel's expression was bland.
"We're hardly friends."
"Nicely put. If you must know, I'm in the doghouse with her. Piece of shit that I am. I can't believe she's taking pity on me."
Herschel smiled slightly. "She figured it was in her best interests. You go down, she goes down with you. None of us wants to see that."
"Oh, God, no," he said. "Have a seat."
"This is fine. I can't stay long."
"I hope you know the kind of trouble you're in."
"Why don't you spell it out for me? I'm not sure if anyone's mentioned it, but the past 4 or 5 days are completely blank as far as I'm concerned."
"Not surprisingly.
You came into the ER with a blood alcohol of 0.24. 3 times the legal limit."
"Says who?"
"They drew blood."
"I had a concussion. I was out."
Herschel shrugged.
"They drew blood when I was out? What horseshit? Can they do that?"
"Sure, under the implied consent law.
When you apply for and receive a driver's license, you consent to a chemical test on request. Even if you'd been conscious, you wouldn't have had much choice. If you'd refused, or tried to, you'd have been charged with a refusal, and they'd have taken the blood anyway, pursuant to Schmerber versus California, a U.S. Supreme Court case about the need to preserve evidence that's dissipating."
"Shit, I love it. Schmerber versus California. Is that all? Give me the rest of it. You're bound to have more."
"You'll be charged with Penal Code 191.5. Gross vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated. That carries 4, 6, or 10 years, unless you have a prior, in which case it's 15 years to life."
"Fuck. When did you get a DUI?
2 years ago. Look it up. The date escapes me."
You'll be charged with VC-20001, subsection C, felony hit and run after a fatal DUI accident.
What are you talking about? What hit and run?
Yours. You left the scene. The cops found you a half a mile away, trudging down the pass all by your lonesome, one shoe off and one shoe on. Remember the nursery rhyme? Hey, diddle dumplin', my son John went to bed with his trousers on, one shoe off and the other shoe on. Walker said, quit already. I know the one you mean. He would have denied it, but he suffered a quick flash of himself stepping on a rock. He'd cussed and hopped on one foot, laughing at the pain. Herschel continued in the same mild tone, his gaze fixed on Walker's. Walker wondered if it was malevolence he was seeing in his eyes, Herschel Rhodes' long-awaited and oh-so-delicious revenge for past slights. You'll be charged with VC-23153 A and B, DUI causing injury. If you've been convicted of a DUI within the past 10 years, you could be charged with second-degree murder under the Watson case. Shit on you, Herschel! I just got done telling you I have a fucking prior, so why don't you stick VC-23153 up your ass? Have you talked to anyone else about this? Just you and my wife. Believe me, that's more than enough. Herschel leaned closer. Because I have one piece of advice for you, pal. Keep your mouth shut. Don't discuss this with anyone. If the subject comes up, you button your lip. You're a deaf mute. You no speak a de language. Are you hearing me? Yes. Good. The doctor's talking about releasing you tomorrow morning. So soon? They need the bed. I'll see if I can talk the cops into waiting until you're home to take you into custody. Otherwise, they'll arrest you right here, handcuff you to the rail, and post a cop outside the door. Whichever way it goes, remember these two words. Shut up. Walker shook his head, saying, shit, under his breath. In the meantime, you'd be smart to put yourself in rehab. At least make a show of cleaning up your act. I can't go into rehab. I have a family to support. AA, then. 3 meetings a week minimum. Daily, if it comes down to it. I want you to look like a guy renouncing his sins and repenting his evil ways. Are you going to get me out of this mess? Probably not, but I'm the best hope you have, Herschel said. If it's any comfort, you won't go to trial for another 3 to 6 months. Speaking of which, I need a check. How much? $20,000 for starters. Once we get to court, we're talking $2,500 a day, plus the cost of expert witnesses. Walker kept his expression neutral, not wanting to give Herschel the satisfaction of seeing his dismay. I'll have to move money over from savings. I don't keep cash like that in my checking account. Can it wait until I get out? Have Carolyn take care of it. Nice seeing you. Chapter 13. Monday, April 11th, 1988. Peephole, California is essentially 2 blocks long and 10 blocks wide, a stone's throw from the Pacific Ocean. A Southern Pacific Railroad track runs parallel to the 101, separating the town from the beach. A tunnel runs under both the train tracks and the highway, making it possible to reach the water if you're willing to walk hunched over through a damp and moldy-smelling 50 yards of culvert. At the northernmost end of town, there's a banana farm. The only other businesses are a service station selling no-name gas and a fresh produce stand that's closed for most of the year. I activated my left turn signal and slowed, eyes pinned on the rearview mirror to make sure no one was plowing into me. At the first break in oncoming traffic, I turned off the highway and crossed the tracks, which put me at the midpoint, half the town to the right of me and half to the left. The ebb and flow of the surf and the surging and receding waves of cars on the highway created a hush of white noise. There was something lazy in the air. My driving tour was brief because there wasn't much to see. The streets were narrow and there were no sidewalks. There were roughly 125 homes in a hodgepodge of architectural styles. Many of the original summer cottages still stood, probably tricked out by now with proper insulation, forced air furnaces, air conditioning units, and triple glazed windows. These were people with storage problems. The yards I passed were littered with everything from boat hulls to broken bird baths to old suitcases. Discarded furniture had been tossed off the porch steps, perhaps awaiting a sweep by the alley fairies. I turned onto